You should have picked up what that place of division is. And so we had talked about chapters 1 through 7 being the first part, chapters 8 through 12 the second part, so we are just moving into the second part. And so chapter 1 is essentially the introduction to the book of Daniel. It gives the context, the where, the who, the why, what's going on. Introduces us to the characters. And then chapters 2 through 7 include revelation regarding the future worldwide rule of particular peoples, kingdoms, and judgments that are going to be associated with those. And then we said that chapter 7 is the hinge between the first and the second parts. And we had noted that chapters 2 through 7 were placed thematically, not focused necessarily on chronology or the whole book itself, because there was a theme that was being communicated. And so the chapter 7 is parallel in many ways to chapter 2 and covers some of the same concepts as far as a summary of future kingdoms and judgments. And it also not only concludes the first part, but it introduces the second part. And so it is the hinge. And then chapters 8 through 12 reveal more details based on that summary of those kingdoms. And it's going to go deal with some of the more specific elements of that, as well as implications for the nation Israel. And that's going to be a change of focus that also is reflected in the language that is used here. So there are two things that signal the beginning of a new section. The first is a return to the Hebrew language. Now remember chapters 1 and through chapter 2 verse 3 were in Hebrew, and then the rest of that section through chapter 7 was in Aramaic. And that had a broader emphasis encompassing the focus that you would expect dealing with these nations as it was having to do with the times of the Gentiles. So you would assume it would be a broader emphasis, which it was. And the second element is the emphasis on the nation Israel. And we assume that Daniel probably wrote the remainder of the book in Hebrew, chapters 8 through 12, because it was more focused on his people in particular. And so, and some have also observed that the book of Revelation follows somewhat of a parallel emphasis. It was written in one language, Greek, in the New Testament, but it does have some similarities of structure. There's an introduction, different ways of outlining the book of Revelation, but basically some similar kinds of things. Revelation 1 through 3 can be understood as introductory as well, and then corresponding with the book of Daniel, chapter 1. And then there's a section dealing with worldwide judgments that follow. Revelation 4 through 11 compare with Daniel 2 through 7, and then the prophecies deal more specifically with Israel. Chapters 12 through 20 of Revelation and 8 through 12 of the book of Daniel. You'll just see a parallel. And you have to observe the similarities, the parallels between the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation anyway, because there is so much overlap that is helpful to note. So chapter 7 recorded the general history of the times of the Gentiles. And it gives somewhat of an overview of what's involved there. From the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when he took the Jews into captivity, to the Son of Man's return to the earth. And then chapter 8 reveals more detail about the second and third kingdoms, and especially how they relate to Israel, with the implications there. It's also been observed that chapter 8 is the last of the book's symbolic visions, where there's a lot of symbolism using animals or other things to depict a particular nation or people or king. And so The other visions are less visual, but still have some things that are not particularly easy to grasp, but they're not as symbolic as they are. So we'll see that when we look at chapters following chapter 8. So we want to think about, what does this vision that we find in chapter 8 communicate to us? What ought we to understand there? So we want to start off, and we're only going to deal with half of the chapter, or not even quite half, given our time frame we have to deal with it today. But we want to get an idea of, okay, what exactly is this vision about? So we want to deal with a description of the vision, and then next time we will look at the interpretation of the vision, though necessarily we will deal with some interpretive details now as well, because we have read the last part of the chapter and we know some of the things that we'll want to point out in advance. So starting off looking at the text, verses 1 and 2, we read, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time." So you have to think, okay, what was the one that we were talking about the first time? Well, it would have been chapter 7. "I saw in the vision, and it so happened, while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai." So you'll notice there twice it says, in the vision, I saw in the vision. That's helpful to distinguish where he actually physically was. Hopefully, we can understand that. Was he actually in Shushan or was he in Babylon? You need to look at the text and see if you can determine from that. So this is giving us some of the contextual circumstances of the vision, giving us a little bit of background to work into it. The timing was near the end of the Babylonian era, and we had previously looked at the summary of the times of the Gentiles, starting off with the Babylonian era, and then the Medo-Persian, and then the Greek, and then the Roman. And this is going back again to the beginning. So we had kind of moved forward, and then we move back again in time looking at this. So the third year of Belshazzar was about 551 BC. And when you think Belshazzar, what picture should come to your mind? I'm not going to show you, but you can think about it. There should be a picture that comes to your mind. Belshazzar, the handwriting on the wall, that ought to jump out at you. That's the imagery that's there. So this time frame is 2 years after the vision of chapter 7. Chapter 7 is that summary picture again with the four animals coming out of the sea that we had looked at. And it was about 12 years before the events of chapter 5. Well, chapter 5 is before this. Remember, we said it wasn't chronological, it was thematic. So you have to keep that in mind. Again, chapter 5 is dealing with the handwriting on the wall that Belshazzar saw, and then his death that happened that same night. So Daniel was then living within the kingdom of Neo-Babylonia. That was that sort of revived emphasis that was going on there in the period of the first beast that was referenced in chapter 7. That was the lion. And apparently this was not a dream per se, combined with a vision, as chapter 7 is referenced, but it is referenced as simply a vision. And kind of maybe it has to do with how you view if there's a distinction between dream and vision. When we looked at chapter 7, it seemed like there was a reference to a dream singular, but visions plural, which would suggest the different aspects of the dream that were taking place. And here is referenced as a vision. Some would make a distinction. One is what happens during the daytime compared to what happens at night. That doesn't hold through completely, but at least gives us a little bit of an idea of what might be in view. So the vision that appeared to Daniel previously refers to the one again in chapter 7, which was the four beast summary vision of the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the vicious beast that's not identified beyond that. Now, the location in the vision was 200 miles east of Babylon. You got to try to get your map in view here. of what that looks like. So evidently, Daniel was in Babylon when he had this vision, but what he saw, including himself, was in Susa, or Shushan, the AV gives. This place is also referenced in Nehemiah, Esther, Ezekiel as well. There are some commentators who suggest that maybe he was physically present in Susa, but the emphasis of saw in the vision two times in verse 2 would suggest that he was probably familiar with Susa, so he recognized it from having been there, perhaps, because of the kinds of things that he was involved in, his responsibilities as one who had administrative tasks that would have involved the larger region. So it's reasonable to assume that a man in Daniel's position in the government would have probably visited this place so that he would have recognized in the vision, or else there was a sign that said Susa, so he knew that that's what it was. So anyway, it was about 200 miles east of Babylon. It was about 150 miles north of the top of the Persian Gulf, if that helps you identify it. And if you're familiar with archaeological finds, this is the place where the Code of Hammurabi was found in 1901, if that gives you a little bit of context. The site of Susa is now modern-day Iran, whereas the site of Babylon is modern Iraq. So, and if you're standing on the border, you're between Iraq and a hard place. Just checking to see if you're awake. Okay, some names and places merit further consideration. The reference to Elam here was the name of the Persian province where Susa stood when Daniel wrote this book, which would have been later than the time of actually having the vision. So after Persia overthrew Babylon, Susa, the former capital of the Elamite kingdom, became one of the capital cities of the Persian Empire. And then 80 years after Daniel had this vision, if you can remember these numbers, 80 years after Daniel had this vision, Susa became Esther's home. So it gives you a little bit of context there. And 107 years later, it was the city from which Nehemiah departed to return to Babylon, to return to Palestine. So, and then the reference to the citadel has to do with probably the palace that housed the royal residence, and it had strong fortifications, which one would expect. And then the reference to the Ulai River is best identified with a canal that connected the rivers Choates with Copratis. Those names are not particularly significant, but it was close by Susa, and that's what we would understand is the context here. So all of this is given to document the time, the places that are involved, which would indicate it's literal, it's to be taken seriously, it wasn't just something that's being made up here. Then looking at the next couple of verses, verses 3 and 4, then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So that's the first part of it that gives a picture of the ram with the two horns. So that's the first imagery that's given here. And we have to think, okay, now what is this referring to? But that's just the beginning. So now we need to look at the next part of it, verses 5 and 6. It says, and as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. So again, there's symbolism, imagery that's given here of these particular creatures. And then looking at verse 7. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So you have these two creatures, the ram, the ram, and then the male goat, and the male goat is having the upper hand. The ram initially had some power and function, but that has now been changed. So that's the picture in general terms that you have to work with. So then we have the introduction of two common but aggressive creatures. You know, a sheep and a goat are not particularly uncommon critters. So the ram with two horns made aggressive movements of expansion and oppression. Are noted here. The ram, which is simply a male sheep that Daniel saw standing before the canal, represented a particular nation, and that nation is given to us in verse 20 when the interpretation is given. So we need to, in order to really start fleshing this out a little bit, we need to recognize, okay, there's a context that's given, and there is a particular name that is given to this. This ram is related to Persia. It corresponds to the bear in the previous vision in chapter 5, verse 7. The two horns represent power. That's how when we see the imagery that's communicated, that's generally what's involved there. And it symbolized Media and Persia, the two different horns. There were two kingdoms that joined together to form an alliance to ultimately create Persia, because Persia ended up being the more powerful of them. The longer horn stood for Persia, which had become the more powerful of the two in this alliance, and then would ultimately displace Media in its leadership after the two nations merge, so that Persia really comes out on top in that imagery that's given here. The ram was also an important symbol for the Persians. It was their particular focus. The guardian spirit of the Persian Empire was portrayed as a ram. When the Persian king went into battle, he carried the head of a ram. That would have been part of their normal routine. I mean, it would be like the teams that people have. They have a mascot. That's kind of what it was in this case. Also, in the ancient world, different zodiac signs represented different nations. And Aries, the ram, stood for Persia, and Capricorn, coming from the Latin, was Greece. So historically, the Persian Empire pushed its borders primarily in three directions that correspond to the imagery that's given in this text. It went westward into Lydia, Ionia, Thrace, and Macedonia. It went northward toward the Caspian Mountains, the Oxus Valley, and Scythia, and southward toward Babylon, Babylonia, Palestine, and Egypt. And then if you look at the imagery that's found in chapter 7, verse 5, of the bear with the three ribs, you can see, well, there may be some imagery here that corresponds with the three areas of their conquering that was involved. And historically, the main moving out in that direction was under Cyrus and Cambyses when they were in leadership. And so what communicates was relates to this ram is that there was a period of time when Persia was the aggressor and was making an impact in the nations around in a particular focus of these particular three directions, and was becoming great in its power and in its own emphasis on itself, maybe an element of arrogance is communicated in the language that's given here, becoming great. But as with most, if not all, earthly kingdoms, it does not last. And that was communicated in chapter 7 as well as then again in chapter 8. So then the male goat furiously attacked and trampled the ram. That's what we saw in the text. And we also know from looking at verse 21, if you have your text open, that this male goat is identified with Greece. So it's very specific that there's a particular context and nation that is in view. And history has confirmed this identification when you look at the various details that are there, which we talked about going through chapter 7 as well. Alexander the Great is the conspicuous horn that is seen on this particular goat. And, of course, we know that goats normally have two horns, so this goat was unusual, and there was certainly something about Alexander that was noteworthy. His armies advanced quickly from the west against Persia. His conquest involved basically almost all of the Near and the Middle East. He did so within 3 years, and that it stands out as a major accomplishment in military history. And so the speed at which he accomplished this is noteworthy. The Persian imperial forces had great numerical superiority. So you would have thought that Persia would have been able to withstand this. They even had special military equipment, including war elephants. I mean, who has war elephants? Not everybody. So that's pretty amazing to think about that. It'd be like having tanks when they first came out. It would have been roughly the equivalent. But they were no match for Alexander with his particular tactical genius and his disciplined Macedonian warriors. So they attacked somewhat with a vengeance, and it was likely because the Persians had previously attacked the Greeks, and so there was this element of retaliation and, you could say, calculated vengeance that was involved. Alexander won two significant battles in Asia Minor, 334 B.C. and 333 B.C. The first was at the Granicus River and then at Issus and Phrygia. And then he finally subdued Persia with a victory at Gaugamela, near Nineveh in 331 B.C. So he had a very specific strategy that he was utilizing and perhaps some element of vengeance in it as well. So Alexander turned out to be a rather formidable foe for Persia. That goat with the one horn is imaging Alexander, and the ram is Persia. And of course, we recognize that Alexander is not called Alexander the Great for nothing, because he did accomplish some major military things in very short period of time. And so that has been duly noted historically. Then, continuing with the text, verses 8 through 10, therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Now, if we already have somewhat of a context put in mind, because the interpretation that we know is coming later in this chapter, when we look at the details here, it helps us to think through it a little bit. So the large horn is going to be broken. It's going to be taken over by four other notable horns that are going to be taking up in its place, that go toward the four winds of heaven. Out of One of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now we need to think about what is that having to do with. And then it came up to the host of heaven. We need to think about, okay, what is that referring to? And it came down, and it cast down some of the host, and, or some would suggest, translating even some of the stars of the ground, or stars to the ground, and trampled them. So again, there's some imagery of what is taking place here. And then we're going to look at verses 11 and 12 here as well to get the bigger picture before we go back and look at the details. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. Now you might see a connection between the sanctuary cast down and truth cast down in terms of the imagery of what it's communicating there. And he did all this and prospered. So that's talking about the little horn, where it came from in relation to the single horn that had been in place previously with the four horns in between. So if you can keep all of that imagery straight, that's what we want to look at next. So we're going to be looking at the demise of the goat and the growth of the little horn. The goat grew strong and then was displaced. If we get the basic details, this, some of the other little things will kind of fit in together. So clearly this description corresponds to that of the third beast in chapter 7, verse 6, relating to the leopard that had four wings and four heads. Talking about the four winds and the four individuals that we will be anticipating here in just a moment. So Alexander had magnified himself greatly in a couple of ways. He had extended the borders of his empire after he conquered Persia, even farther east and into the Afghanistan area and into the Indus Valley, into as far as getting in toward India. His empire covered 1.5 million square miles. That's a fair amount. And he became extremely arrogant. He regarded himself as divine and even made his soldiers bow down to him. What's that going to do for you? Well, it didn't do too much for him because it resulted in his troops revolting against him, which is not surprising. And a lot of expositors, both liberal and conservative, have interpreted this verse as representing the untimely death of Alexander and then his division, the division of his empire into four major sections. So Alexander had conquered more of the world than any previous leader, but he was not able to conquer himself. Of course, that's a problem that many individuals have. There were various factors that led to his demise. One was the strenuous exertion that he had and what he was trying to accomplish. And then he had a life of dissipation, and he had a raging fever that some have identified with perhaps syphilis. And he died in a drunken debauch in Babylon, and he was not even quite 33 years of age. So his death was untimely, largely based on his own choices that he had made. But he had accomplished a great deal, and therefore he has been revered as Alexander the Great. But he left a great conquest without a replacement, without someone to fill in the void, and there was no effective single leader to handle things. And so it took about 20 years for the empire to sort of sift out, and then it was ultimately divided into four functional sections. And as we had noted back in our study of Daniel chapter 7, verse 6, that the most probable identification of the four horns was Lysimachus, Cassander, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And they are referenced later and associated to chapter 11, verse 4 of Daniel, associated with the four winds, which corresponds to some of the other things. So Lysimachus ruled the northern part of the empire, Cassander the western part. That would be like over toward Macedonia in that area. Seleucus the eastern part, Assyria, that area. Ptolemy the southern part would have been Israel and Egypt and down in that area. So Alexandria is understood to be the large horn of the goat, based on our historical understanding and basically examining the text in its context. His influence was monumental in many ways, and it even impacted the communication of the Word of God, because he spread the language of Greek. The New Testament is written in Greek. It facilitated the spread of the gospel because of the common culture that had been spread around. And if you remember Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, in the fullness of time, God sent his son, born of a woman, and so on. That's part of that fullness of time, preparation for things. And then you add what Rome was able to do in terms of providing transportation means and additional means of peace, that the Pax Romana that was going on, all of that is being prepared for here. Then a little horn grew greatly and exalted himself over a people. So Daniel next saw a rather small horn. Verse 23, later on in the interpretational part of it, is going to identify it as a king. And it grows out of one of the four horns, those kingdoms that we just had referenced. And this little horn had replaced the single horn on the goat after the division of those other horns, as being one that had some significant impact. So, and also we should note that this little horn is different than the little horn that came up among the ten horns of the fourth beast that's noted in chapter 7, verse 8. But there's a parallel likely between. Some suggest that this little horn of the text we're looking at here in chapter 8 is probably a precursor or a prototype of the little horn of the fourth kingdom, and it's probably the most helpful way to identify it, because there are definitely some similarities, but they are not identical, and the time frame differs as well, because one took place historically prior to the time of Christ, and the other takes place after the time of Christ, because he predicts the implications of that, and that would relate to the Antichrist. But the crisis that God's people experienced during the time of the little horn that we would identify with Antiochus Epiphanes, that we'll look at in a moment, had a lot of similarities to what would befall the people in the times when the Antichrist would come along. So there would be some eschatological or final phase details associated with the fourth kingdom that would take place in the last days, and Christ himself refers to this in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, verse 15, where the things that were dealt with, that Daniel is dealing with here, had implications for that time, but also for the future, because the abomination of desolation is still seen as yet future, even though it had a parallel prior to that. So this little horn grew very great to the south, to the east, and to the glorious land. So the first question in light of that is, what is the reference point for these directions? Where is one standing to think about the south, the east, and the glorious land? Well, since history has identified this little horn as Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the eighth king of the Seleucid dynasty. He ruled Syria from 175 to 164. That's noted in 1 Maccabees, one of the apocryphal books that we don't accept as inspired or inerrant, but it does have helpful history. He conducted military campaigns in the particular directions that are noted here, according to 1 Maccabees 1:20. And so it would seem that the reference point then would be Syria, where you're looking from the particular area of south and east, and then the glorious land from there. Well, then the next issue is, well, what's the identification of the glorious land here? Well, it seems to be a reference to the Holy Land. There are other passages, chapter 11, 16, 41, 45, that references and indicate it's referring to the land of Israel, Jeremiah 3, 19, Ezekiel 20, 6, and 15. So other passages that are noted for you that you can check out. So here the vision begins to focus on the future of Israel and the Jews, and what we see from history is that Antiochus, here Antiochus Epiphanes or the fourth, had some real issues with the Jews. They were not cooperative. Basically, he wanted to bring unity to all these areas and wanted everybody to just get on board. For some reason, the Jews just didn't want to go along with that. They didn't want to capitulate and give up their theological understanding of monotheism. There's only one God, and they just were just kind of stubborn that way, which was a good thing. But that was a problem for Antiochus, and so he took out his vengeance on them for them not being cooperative. In one assault on Jerusalem, there were 40,000 Jews that were killed in 3 days, and there were another 10,000 that were carried away in captivity. And so this oppression came to a head in December of 165 BC when Antiochus returned in frustration from Alexandria, Egypt, where he had been turned back by a Roman commander. And in his frustration, he vented it on the Jews. In his exasperation, he sent one of his generals, Apollonius, with 20,000 troops under orders to seize Jerusalem on the Sabbath. And he erected an idol of Zeus there and desecrated the altar by offering swine on it. And this would become known at that time as to the Jews as the abomination of desolation, and it was indeed a type that then Christ referred to in Matthew chapter 24 of what is going to be taking place in the future. And 4 years later, after this oppression that was instigated by Antiochus, on December 25th, the same day 4 years later, 164 BC, Judas Maccabeus, who was a Jewish nationalist, led the Jews in rededicating the temple to Yahweh and had a revolt against Antiochus. And this event was what precipitated the celebration of Hanukkah. So if you want to tie that with that particular picture. So that's, I think, another significant detail.